Hello and welcome to Two Nerds Sitting on a Couch, in which two nerds sit on a couch and discuss science fiction and fantasy.
Two Nerds is here today to talk about Twilight.
Which is a movie that not many people have seen. It's pretty obscure.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, surprising that I haven't seen anybody discussing this movie anywhere.
No, it's, I think we're probably solidly 10 years too late for this podcast, but it's fine.
Yeah.
It's totally fine.
But I think it's time to revisit its crepuscularity.
Yeah.
And really delve into what makes it, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
A movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you have to talk about like Stephanie Meyer and the phenomenon too before you like get to the movie. I think even, I mean, like when I signed on to Goodreads in I think 2007, Goodreads was basically made out of Twilight reviews. Like that was just what there was. Like,
I mean, I think I may have even read Twilight.
Really?
Possibly. It was a long time ago.
Yeah. I've read Twilight at the
time. I mean, I know I read 50 Shades of Grey.
Did you?
Well, now that I say it out loud, I may have just seen the movie.
The movie is a million times better because it doesn't have prose in it. And her prose is just awful. Anyway, but like, I don't know. I think one of the interesting things about the Twilight phenomenon is that like, it really, like, I ended up being, like, a Twilight defender a lot of the time. Not because I don't think that it isn't, like, hugely regressive and the sexual politics are just completely bizarre and all of that stuff. But because I felt like a lot of the attacks on Twilight were ad hominem. Uh-huh. Meaning, the problem was it appealed to girls and girls are gross. Therefore, right. We hate Twilight. Anything that is girly is bad. And I think that's still often the case when people go after Twilight.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that it takes itself seriously. You know, like there are tons of rom-coms out there that are, you know, totally, totally fine. You know, some of them are even really good. But like Twilight is a rom and
without the com.
Yeah. I mean, because there's not... there's not anything intentionally funny.
excellent adverb, my dude. That was amazing. No, there is. I don't think there is anything intentionally funny, but yeah. Whew. So I went back and like I had a pretty well-known Twilight review, which I went back and reread because I hadn't looked at it for ages, and like, the one thing I had forgotten when I read, like, one of my reactions to it was I thought that the way Stephanie Meyer, like, captured a certain kind of, like, horrifically awkward, uncharitable adolescence was really, really accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Bella Swan, like, it's in the first person, right? She doesn't like anybody. She is completely bound up in her like constant social anxiety and her like feelings of awkwardness and like the clumsiness is actually just like literally like it's like a pathetic fallacy almost. Mm-hmm. Because she's just completely eaten up with anxiety about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And has a very hard time taking pleasure in anything. The only thing that she finds enjoyable is her time with Edward, which is fucked up because he's totally Jesus.
Yeah.
But I felt a lot of discomfort reading it because I was like, I feel like this is kind of accurate in a way that makes me not feel like great about my younger self.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, right. She's not a likable person on any level.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the part of the problem with the movie is that it doesn't telegraph that stuff all that well, you know, because it's trying to like ride a really fine line between making Bella into a character that everybody wants to be while also making her a character that everybody doesn't want to be, you know, like, which makes it tough because it's like, I think in the movie it comes across as less awkward and more just sort of dismissive or, you know, arrogant or, you know, I mean, I don't know that the movie really, like, it gets the clumsiness kind of because she falls over once, but like, that's not a character trait, you know?
No, but I mean, that's always been the criticism of Bella Swan, is that, like, that's not a character flaw. Right. Like, the character flaw, like, and I also actually have some, like, warmth in my heart for Stephenie Meyer because I don't think she's in control of anything she writes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all just coming out and just completely, like, she's just not in control of it.
Yeah, but I do think she manages to capture something real, even if it's in like accidental.
Oh no, absolutely. She thinks the character flaw is that Bella's clumsy, and that's not the character flaw.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing I also read was this is where I find Meyer so like kind of charming. Like for the 10th anniversary of Twilight, she rewrote a gender flipped Twilight.
Oh God, yeah.
And this is so fucking crazy to me. So she didn't just flip the genders of Bella and Edward. She flipped literally everyone's gender.
Yeah.
Cause that's the craziest like response you could do to criticisms that her stuff is anti-feminist.
Yeah.
And like, and I read it and she just totally proves her point because it totally does not end the way Twilight ends. Like,
yeah, which it's sort of funny because it's like, I mean, was she trying to prove a point or was it that she was just exploring what would happen?
A little bit of both. I mean, I think that she was genuinely hurt by those criticisms. I think she really felt like she wasn't being anti-feminist.
Yeah. Well, I think she was being an awful lot of things, and I think anti-feminist is a bit strong for what she was. But a lot of what she was just sort of, I don't know. I mean, like, the whole thing reads as an abusive relationship. Absolutely. From start to finish. You know, yeah, what I mean? Yeah. It's just like, and that's the problem with it. It's not necessarily anti-feminist so much as it's just gross.
Yeah, no, you know? The sexual politics are really, really repellent.
Because he spends the whole time, at least on the movie, telling her, you know, that she needs to go away, leave him alone, and like not be in a relationship, and yet he spends the whole time chasing after her, mm-hmm. and like being like this creepy stalker protector, mm-hmm. which if you think about it follows a long-standing pattern in, and we've talked about this in King Kong, where you have the monster and Godzilla for that matter, the monster who is objectively frightening and destructive becoming the protector in this sort of fucked up, like, abusive relationship, right. You know? And that's what, this is just another example of that in monster movies. Mm-hmm. Like, because it is, I mean, for as high-functioning zombies as vampires are,
right.
It's still a monster movie, you know? I mean, it's like, it's a lot of what they do in the beginning of it, it's playing as a horror movie because, like, there's a series of deaths.
Right.
Murders that at first they attribute to animals, and then we're supposed to kind of believe that maybe it's our vampires, but then we start to realize that it's another set of vampires, and now those sets of vampires are after Bella for some reason because she just smells so good.
Oh my God. Oh,
she's like the best smelling food, and they just have to like eat her. And I mean, and that's another thing that's like kind of funny about Edward's character, speaking of abusive relationships, where it's like, she's like a forbidden fruit, you know? I mean, like, sex mm-hmm. is like, maybe, but like, I mean, the reality is just being near her is a temptation for him. Yeah. And the temptation is that he's going to eat her. And that whole metaphor is a metaphor of sex. If you have premarital sex, you are going to hell.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Your soul will be damned. And like, and that's, you know, and again, it's not that that's anti-feminist. It's just gross.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, like, this is a longstanding thing in like feminist criticism, but like vampires, you know, hang out biting people and it's totally like penetration. You know what I mean? Like, that's, it is absolutely 100% sex.
Right.
And, like, the fact that they're often all as well the parasitic rich, you know, which actually the Cullens kind of are.
Yeah, no, they totally are. I mean, like, Dr. Cullen is a doctor and all of the kids just sort of hang out, I guess, living off their trust funds because...
Right.
And otherwise, there's not really a
high school.
Like, small town doctors don't really make enough money to buy a house like that in the middle of
And I mean, this, they don't really get into this in this movie or book, but like Alice is like constantly wearing very fancy designers. Like, they definitely have shit tons of money.
Yeah.
Shit tons of money.
Well, and I mean, she's so vain that like everybody else is wearing a wristband with their family crest on it, and hers is a necklace.
Well, of course it is.
Because she can't just, I mean, she can't wear a wristband. That's gauche.
No. She wouldn't.
Which is funny, because I never noticed the family crest thing until this last time. Yeah. It's like we watch it on HD, and now all of a sudden all these little details start popping out.
It's totally true. It's totally true.
I gotta say, the glittery vajazzling of Edward's face is so much more resplendent in 4K.
Yeah, I gotta say that that's definitely something that they dropped after this movie as a thing.
Which it's dumb.
Because, I mean, it's just an example of, like, there's a ton of stuff in Twilight that kind of works on the page. Because you're, like, insulated by Bella's interiority.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, on screen. And that happens kind of a lot, actually, I think, with these movies. Is that they have to, like... shoot around the weird shit.
Yeah. Well, and to back up, because most people haven't seen this movie and don't know the plot. Bella's mother is dating some sort of minor league baseball player and wants some alone time with him to travel. And Bella is like, fine, I will go stay with Dad. And it kind of comes out that her mom is like kind of a, you know, mess. And Bella
and always
been sort of
has been
taking care of her and acting as a parent, which is a terrible relationship. And then when she moves in with her dad, like, she kind of drops into the same role, you know, and mm-hmm. it, and it's just the neglect that implies, and the fact that her parents are messes. It's, I don't know. I mean, it kind of resonates with me as like, you know, Gen X was the latchkey generation. You know, our parents just sort of, I mean, we didn't have cell phones. And so we were just sort of expected to be home for dinner at a certain time, you know. And like, if we weren't home for dinner at a certain time, they'd be mad, but they wouldn't call the cops.
God, no.
They would, you know, they would probably wait a good solid 24 hours because we might have just been sleeping over to a friend. You know, I mean, so like there was this sort of benign neglect, or I mean, in some cases,
like, less
malign
than benign
neglect. But it was just sort of understood that we were taking care of ourselves. And in some cases, we were taking care of our parents as well, because they were kind of unable to function as adults.
I have a number of friends. And actually, that is something interesting to point out, that she is an Xer. Like, mm-hmm. for however much she grew up in a Mormon household or whatever, like, she's one of us. But yeah, I had tons of friends whose parents were really not very functional. And they were doing things like writing out the bills very, very young.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they didn't, no one would.
Yeah, which for a kid is pretty psychologically damaging, because you don't have anybody taking care of you when you're a kid. And so you don't expect anyone to take care of you as an adult. And it really screws up your relationships, you know?
Right.
Like, that's a hard thing to get through. And you're never allowed to be a kid. And it's just like, it just sort of underscores that, where it's like, it's an abusive relationship. And she talks about her father as liking her father, because he just sort of like butts out and doesn't whatever. But it's like, I mean, that's just sort of a really nice way of saying that he's neglectful, even though, I mean, he comes across as wanting to, like, you know, whatever, he wants to do stuff with her, but it's not stuff that she would want to do.
Well, and like, I, you know, my memory of from the books is like, she's very critical of her mother,
mm-hmm.
You know, for good reason. But it's just kind of clear in the text that Charlie is completely out of his depth.
Yeah.
Like, he's never meaningfully lived with her. My understanding is that I think they broke up when she was like 2 or 3. So she doesn't have memories of living in the same house with him.
Well, plus he's got that sort of like, you know, toxic fatherhood thing where he's got all these ideas about
like what he should do.
Yeah, like how he needs to protect her and whatever. And it's like, okay, too little, too late, man. Mm. And also completely misguided.
Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of two strikes right off the bat, you know?
Right.
Speaking of strikes right off the bat.
Oh. Yeah, we can't get there so fast, right?
Okay, let's spend some time
talking
about the real hero of this movie, Jessica.
Oh,
so
yes.
Jessica is played by Anna Kendrick, and it's really really well. She's the real hero of this movie, but you wouldn't know it. I mean, because a lot of the screen time focuses on a different character.
Yeah,
several other characters have way more screen time, but it's pretty clear that Anna Kendrick is the real character arc of this story because she starts as a wonderful young woman who is really just looking for friendship and love.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of the movie, like, you really don't see her again.
It's
really sad because I am totally 100% there for Jessica, and she is such a great friend and someone to talk to about your problems with your monstrous boyfriend.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and I do think it's kind of funny because when you first told me that, like, Edward is supposed to be Jesus, like a Mormon Jesus, it's just sort of weird that it's this. I mean, I mean, it's Mormon. I don't know a lot about Mormons, but I know in the Catholic Church, it's a whole cult of cannibalism where it's like it's a lot about drinking blood. I mean, that is like an enormous facet of Christian religion.
I think the Catholics definitely go ham on the blood thing, though. That's not as, I mean, as somebody who's raised Protestant. I mean, actually, I found out recently.
They didn't have trays of drinks in their church?
No.
No, well, no little cups of blood?
Well, we did when I was going to a Baptist church.
Oh.
But that was actually grape juice because they didn't drink, so.
Yeah. Yeah, which is just sort of funny because it's like, what exactly are you trying to symbolize?
Yeah, then? but the Mormons are just Christian with like some other stuff added on. Like it's all within the same kind of paradigm.
Well, yeah, it's Christians with masonry added on. Like they're Masonic Christians.
Yeah, no, that's about right.
But yeah, so I mean, you've got this like sort of these ties to Edward being Jesus, but also he is textually and self-referentially a monster. Like mm-hmm. Jesus is a monster.
Yeah.
And this is where I think that Stephanie Meyer is kind of writing from that hindbrain because it's like, you know, I think a lot of people are brought up with Jesus as this, like, it's Buddy Jesus, right? Where it's like, you know, he's just somebody you talk to in your head or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But to in a very real way, he is completely unknowable, right? I mean, like, you don't, if it's really God, like, how much can you really know God with your biblically accurate angels with all of their extra wings and eyeballs glaring at you? And it's like frightening and whatever. So, yeah, I mean, and he's, it's just sort of interesting that's the text is that he is a monster, you know, he is like literally a horror monster.
Well, and also, I mean, I think the other funny thing about him is that, like, I think it's notable how much, like, the relationship is absolutely 100% fueled by Bella. She's the one pushing for it. And she's the one pushing for more sexual content
and in some books becoming a vampire.
Yeah, well, that, yeah, she starts pushing to become a vampire like in at the end of
which is not to say Edward's not like, he's totally into it, right? I mean, he keeps telling her that you know, she needs to stop pursuing him because he's totally gonna be there because he can't stay away from her. And it's like it's coded as this, you know, this temptation that he can't control.
Right. Because
boys can't control.
But this is like a really traditional view of sexuality, right?
Yeah.
It's the woman's fault. Although, interestingly, like, the woman is the one who's tempting the man, and she's the one who's got the inherent sexuality. And, like, this is what makes him Jesus, is the fact that he can say no. And does, consistently. always say no.
If he has sex with her, that'll turn her into a monster. And
right.
He's had sex, and he doesn't want her to be a monster like him.
No, he, well, I mean, I guess only metaphorically, though.
Right, metaphorically.
Because he, my understanding is he was a virgin. Oh, yeah. And another fun fact, he died during the 1918 Spanish flu.
Yeah, he had the COVID flu of his time.
Yep. Yep. So he's got long COVID.
Yeah. Apparently makes you cold and very, very white.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, you often have, like, so we talk about, like, what does the monster mean, right? And mm-hmm. for vampires, like, we often settle on it's a like a class warfare thing, or it can be a AIDS epidemic thing, depending on how, like, if it's tainted blood or whatever.
Right.
And like this, you know, fear of blood transfusions and stuff like that, which my understanding is Mormons also don't do blood transfusions, or is that just Jehovah's Witnesses?
I think that's just JWs.
Yeah. They do have some weird relationships with blood, though. But anyway, like, I don't know. I mean, in this case, it's sort of hard to tell, because it's, you know, I mean, I know Edward thinks he's a monster, but, like, I mean, let's be realistic. You get to live forever. You have this, like, you know, glowy, otherworldly skin. Like, realistically, you would be ruling the world.
Right. There's and really, like, no,
what's
downside.
The downside? There is no downside. There's no downside. So, I mean, you just sort of, like, Edward's got this whole thing where it's like, well, now I don't have a soul. And it's like, well, then why don't you just eat me? I mean, I feel like Buffy did a much better job with the vampires in that, because they, at that point, like, the losing your soul part meant that you kind of wanted to eat other people. I mean, it didn't mean that you were no longer fun at parties. It meant that you no longer were ruled by any kind of empathy or conscience.
Right.
And with this, it's his only indication of being a monster is his own belief that vampires don't have souls, and that that's important.
Yeah.
And although, for Jesus to say, it's a little weird.
It is a little weird. Although I do have to say, like, do we even get into, there's no religious language in the movies, I don't believe. Does he talk about the loss of a soul? I don't think so.
No, maybe not. But I mean, what, he definitely talks about it in real world terms. Like, this is the skin of a killer, Bella, which is one of those unintentionally funny things. I mean, there are so many little things like that in the movie where it's just like, it's just hilarious. I mean, this is why it's a fun movie, is because if you go into it thinking you're supposed to take it seriously, then it's like, I mean, fine, I guess if you're into that sort of thing. But if you go into it thinking that there's, like, all of this, it's like gothic in its mm-hmm. in its hilarity, you know, because she walks in the room, she's standing in front of a fan, and the fan blows her scent to him, and he just looks disgusted. I mean, he really does look
grossed out. He actually, like, puts his hand over his nose and mouth like he's gonna barf.
Yeah, and like, and she plays it up because, like, she's smelling her armpits, like, she's a big stinky adolescent or whatever, you know, which is just really, really funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's supposed to be, but it really is.
Although, the funny thing is, like, so the director of this one, and I think this is the only one that she did, is a woman called Catherine Hardwicke. And I believe, I have to look this up, but I believe the movie she did before this was called 13.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 13-year-old girls, and it is fucking brutal.
I don't think I've seen that one.
So I, as a filmmaker, I wouldn't put it past her to be treating this like a gothic comedy, because that's kind of what it is.
And speaking of gothic comedies, can we talk about baseball yet?
Yeah, absolutely. We can totally
because
talk about baseball.
That was by far the funniest thing to happen in a movie, like, from that decade.
Yeah.
Because they're like, we're going to play baseball. And
okay,
then,
right. So this is one of the many things where it's like, it kind of works on the page because it's insulated by her interiority. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely fucking hilariously stupid on screen.
Yeah, because you can only play during a lightning storm because, you know, you're hitting this ball so hard that it sounds like thunderous, loud clap. And it's like, you know, if there wouldn't be a ball left, if it were really that loud, the amount of energy expended would probably destroy a good chunk of the ball and the bat.
Right. And also, like, this is another example, like, When she's talking about moving to Forks, she's like, "Bloody, there's this town in Washington called Forks, population 230." And I was like, "Meyer Googled that." She Googled that number.
Yeah.
And she Googled about the Pacific Northwest because they don't have thunderstorms there. I don't know if you remember when Steven moved here from the Pacific Northwest, he was so excited by Midwestern thunderstorms. He'd never really experienced them.
They don't have tornadoes over there either.
No.
But it's just sort of funny because it's like, you know, Merriam-Webster dictionary defines... Like, that's how you would start a high school paper.
Absolutely. You know? Which is why, like, on the level that Twilight works, that's why it works.
Yeah.
Shit like that is why it works. Because there's something, like, so familiar and like, perfectly tuned adolescence about it.
Yeah. But it is sort of, like, crazy that it's, like, the Cullenses are this, just the absolute whitest rich people,
And...
The vampires who show up who've been killing other people around, it's like the two of them are white and one of them is black, and that guy ends up being the stand up guy who's like, you know, yo, this other guy is off his cracker. Nut. He's just not gonna let up or whatever. And it's just sort of like that's a dumb motivation and it's a dumb plot. Because now all of a sudden it's like you have your monster protecting you from the other monsters, which is King Kong.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, with that, in that case, like King Kong has a lot of like racial subtext in this. It only does insofar as like she doesn't really get into her racist shit about Native Americans in this book. That only happens later because unfortunately the Quileute are real people as well,
right?
Which
and speaking of unintentionally funny, like I just can't wait until Jacob turns into a wolf on screen. That's just,
oh my god, it's just the comedy gold,
super hilarious. So like they play baseball and that's now the scary thing, and then this guy is after them and they need to run away, and it's a lot of hijinks involving, you know, you drive this way with her, and it's like, aren't you, like, why don't all seven of you just go home?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, wouldn't that be safer to have seven of you waiting for this one guy?
Right? Yeah.
Like, it's, you can take him.
Yeah.
Easily.
You can take him. So, yeah. No, but, like, I really feel like she got, because as I recall, this is just appended to the very end of the novel. This takes place in like the last 80%. Mm-hmm. It's like she was like, fuck, I can't just have a book about feelings. I have to make something happen.
Right.
And so she tacked this on at the end, which is kind of a shame, actually, because I feel like just having a novel about feelings would have been good enough.
And I do think, though, that like the whole metaphor of baseball, she was trying on some level to get Bella to first base. But it just couldn't happen.
Over the shirt. Under the... Anyway.
Yeah.
And also, the family has matching uniforms. They have baseball uniforms.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they love baseball a lot. And I guess if you've been alive for hundreds of years, you need to have hobbies. And so why not? But it just seems weird that it would be baseball. I mean, there are so many other things that rich people do. Like, why not vampire polo?
But I mean, obviously, you know, Meyer really loves her vampires. She thinks they're really stand-up people. And the baseball is just like... It's America's sport, you know?
Yeah, I guess. You think that's why she picked baseball?
Uh-huh.
Like, I mean, metaphorically, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. But I really think it's just as simple as that. I don't think you need to be looking for deeper depths.
No, there. I would never look for deeper depths in anything she does.
Oh, no, I would look for deeper depths all the time.
No, but like not intentional ones. I just don't think in that.
Well, yeah, nobody said anything about intentionality.
Right.
I just think that I just don't think that there's much. I could be convinced otherwise, but I don't see it. I just think that she just feels like that's really American. And it's a way of showing how wholesome they are.
Yeah, no, totally. And I mean, I don't know. I feel like there are other things that you can't like look at this movie in any kind of real metaphorical way, because it's like, okay, Edward's Jesus. Mm-hmm. And what does Jesus do? Well, he listens to your prayer. So Edward can read people's minds.
Yep.
Which ends up meaning he, you know, he knows when you've been sleeping, he knows when you're awake, right? He's making a list and checking it twice. And like, so this guy, you know, drives all the way to some other city to stalk his girlfriend and then hears some nasty thoughts from some guys who want to attack her.
Right.
And then, you know, shows up to help and whatever. And so he can read minds, you know, and it's like, so Jesus is listening to your prayers, except he can't read hers. And that doesn't make any sense on any kind of like metaphorical level then. Because it's like she doesn't have some sort of personal relationship with Jesus then, or
well,
what?
I think you don't. I think you just can't, like, because the problem is, like, I think it's one of those interesting sort of dramatic ironies, right? Because Twilight is written in the first person, so we can actually literally hear her thoughts.
Yeah.
Like, this is what she's thinking about.
Right.
And he can't hear her thoughts, or there's no novel. You know what I mean? Because if he knows what she's thinking, he just knows that she's basic like the rest of us. Like, there's nothing interesting or notable about her thought patterns. She is just as basic as everybody else.
In the hand of a better writer, that you could have him reading her thoughts and also finding, like, you know, reading between the lines of her thoughts to find something other than what she thinks she is. You know, which would have been a pretty interesting thing, but yeah. I don't think she could have done that.
But I mean, like, on some, and I think this is even said explicitly in the text, that like part of the reason he's drawn to her is that like he actually has to go through the bother of getting to know her.
Oh, sure.
Like, he actually has to go through the
court her.
Well, right, because he can't just know what she's thinking all the time like everyone else.
Yeah.
And so he actually has to be like, what are you thinking?
Well, yeah, and from his point of view, that would make her more interesting than other people, just because it's like he doesn't know what she's thinking, which, if you think about it, means that all of us are really not all that interesting to Jesus either. Because, you know, and I've, to be honest, like, so as,
before.
Exactly, I mean, as an atheist, I have, like, always wondered about prayer. Like, what is prayer for? And I finally decided at one point that it's just there to be a kind of meditation. Because, like, you can't ask God for stuff if God is omnipotent, omniscient, and all-knowing whatever. What's the other one?
That was all of them.
No, omniscient, omnipotent, and...
Omnipotent.
Omnipotent is omnipotent.
That was a really
all
hilarious
good, all-knowing and all-powerful.
Yeah, that's it.
Omnipotent and...
Beneficent.
Beneficent. Okay. I thought it was going to be a...
It's not an omni, no.
Omni something.
That would be better.
It's reading, like, writing, and arithmetic.
I was going to say, it's like the three R's.
Yeah, so anyway, but that God is not, I mean, he already knows what your prayers are, and he's already decided whether they fit into his ineffable plan or not. And, like, you know, I mean, so praying to God is, like, really pointless, because unless it's, like, God demands it of you, that, like, well, I know, it's like Dr. Manhattan. Like, I know how this is going to go. Well, why do we do it? Well, because we've already had the conversation.
Right.
You know, we have to, because that's what happened. And it's just sort of like, it just sort of underscores the ridiculousness of the whole thing, where it's like, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so Bella has to pray out loud.
Right. Well, and I also think, just on like a, like, part of the reason that everybody got so excited about this is that, like, you know, I mean, Bella's pretty basic. She's like your like B plus English major, you know, like, or whatever. She's a B plus reader girl.
Right.
Right. Like, she totally has a mug that says "fuck off, I'm reading." Oh,
right.
No, wait. I'm for sure it's like the bunnies version of that.
Right.
And, like, you know, she has pretty, you know, she does a lot of that, like, I'm not like other girls, you know, and like. And her awkwardness, like, all of this sort of adds up to, like, you take the average, like, kind of bookish young woman, and she can absolutely identify with what's going on there,
mm-hmm.
up to the point where he couldn't read my mind either. Boys can't read my mind. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're, like, vampires are just like us. And Bella is just like us, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it allows you to just, like, go right into that.
But, I mean, I guess if you want... a good foil in your story, I think Bella's the perfect foil for someone like Jessica, who is a straight A student, who's not basic. She has great hobbies, and, like, she's all around, like, a better person.
I think Jessica's really wonderful, and I think it sucks how much, like Bella is just, like, constantly irritated and kind of shitting on her a little bit in the book.
Yeah.
Because she's, And this is the other irony, I think, is that, like, part of the reason why I ended up a Twilight Defender is that there is precious little girl pulp out there, especially on film.
Right.
There's very, very few films that are made and, like, catering to that sort of girly, like, that whole girly thing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and obviously we can criticize it and talk about the construction of femininity and all that nonsense, but, like, there are how many fucking Transformers movies are there? Which is just like people peeing on each other and shooting things or whatever.
Right. But
like, it's boy pulp and that's fine. There's not, well, okay, there's plenty. Again, we can criticize it, but like part of the reason that Twilight was so successful is that it did cater to a need for a girl pulp. And
well, it, yeah, I mean, I think part of it was catering to an existing user base, like the customers were already there because it was wildly popular before it was a movie,
right? But I think,
which is why they made a 50 Shades of Grey movie.
And I think it's such a shame. Well, but 50, we, that's a whole other conversation that was probably not worth getting into.
Well, but I don't want to watch it for this either.
No, I'm not watching that. Because I, yeah, oh my god, like, did I tell you I wrote a review quote of that back in the day? And like, somebody, one of my friends was like, yeah, I like, you know, I like cut and pasted it into a Word doc so I could read it offline. She's like, it was 20,000 words. Because, like, I had so much fucking shit to say about that stupid book.
Yeah, not the least of which is that it should have been 255 Shades of Grey. Ugh. Because that would have been, you know, actually technically accurate. Or the other problem is that, I mean, were there? I only counted about 13 shades.
I don't know. Whatever. I'm moving on.
Yes, let's talk about Jessica some more.
Oh, right. Where was I going, though? I had a point.
About?
Something.
Girl pulp?
Yeah, girl pulp. Anyway, just that I think it's a shame that, like, because the movies were very, very successful.
Yeah.
And I think, especially because the later ones really, really lean in hard to the girl pulp thing.
Right.
Like, that last movie actually replays the other movies within the movie. Because they're like, remember all this stuff that you love?
Yeah.
And everybody was like, yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's a shame that kind of nobody took the message from that, that we should be catering more towards, you know, this kind of girl pulp.
Yeah.
I'm hard pressed to come up with other things. Wink Saga maybe, but that's for much younger kids.
Yeah.
And it's not a movie.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I could think of many that weren't, that weren't like rom-coms, you know?
Right. Like, and there's precious few of those made these days too.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we watch enough of them that it's,
we do, but it's not like the, you know, the age of When Harry Met Sally or whatever,
where, yeah,
they,
no,
where,
that's
where there
true.
Were like multiple iconic,
all starring Meg Ryan,
yeah, well, she starred in a lot of them, but yeah, like it's just not as common these days.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure why, and I don't know that there's like necessarily a boy version of this sort of pulp, because
yeah, there is. It's like Transformers. It's all those action films. Those are adolescent boy.
But I mean, with Transformers, films. The problem is that a lot of that stuff doesn't take itself seriously at all because it is pee jokes, and it's like, you know, because it's a lot of like, dude, where's my car? Garbage. Even if it's like overall an action movie, like Pacific Rim or Battleship or all of these like kind of male like dominated movies are all basically comedies. Those are like you know, action coms. And I think it's kind of funny that like the one I can think of that's an exception to that is like The Matrix, which really took itself seriously.
Right.
And that would have been, I think, Keanu Reeves described it as a,
Dramaction is the word you're looking for.
Which
I'm still angry about that portmanteau. I mean, I know everybody loves Keanu Reeves and he is obviously amazing.
Yeah.
But that is a terrible portmanteau.
I'm just saying the rest of them were all dramedies and you know, but I don't know. I mean, because you do have things like, well, like Save the Last Dance or Step Up or those sorts of movies that are about women and relationships that are geared towards women primarily.
Those are 20 years old now. 25.
Yeah, no, nothing recent for sure. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I mean, and maybe it's just that we're not aware of them. We're not the demographic,
and
maybe.
That may be some of it. Is it like, as much as I love teen bullshit, like, I fucking live for teen bullshit. And, like, I've gotten to an age where I'm just like, I can't tell any people apart.
Fate the Wink Saga.
I have a really, really, yeah, Fate the Wink Saga. We were watching that with our kid, and, like,
we all were having trouble telling them apart,
we
though.
We just couldn't tell, like, those guys apart.
They went to, like, an Abercrombie & Fitch and just emptied the store out, and they were like, okay, your name is Joe, and your name is John. No, you're Joe, and you're John. Yes, they both start with J, and you're Jason.
God. Yeah, it was so bad. I couldn't even.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that they weren't. No, actually, it was. They weren't interesting characters. There was no differentiation in the characters themselves because they all basically did the same thing and had the same approach to life. And the one that didn't was like, oh, I know that guy.
Yeah, right, right. Although, I mean, with that show, the girls were, you could differentiate the girls.
Yeah, you totally could.
And I was like super 100% there for the bitchy one.
Yeah, but they all wore, like, different colors and different outfits, and the boys all wore the same damn thing.
Yeah, actually, they literally had a uniform.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a literal uniform.
That does make it
so
tough.
So that made it really, really hard. And they all had the same, like, hair. I don't know. They all needed haircuts.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm still sort of stuck on the whole, like, what's the point of it being a vampire story? Why have it be vampires? Like, what good does that do you? Why not skip the vampire parts and just write it as a love story where he's trying to figure her out? Like, what does being a vampire do? And it does something. I just can't figure it out, you know?
Well, I mean,
because I don't know that I would have watched this movie if it didn't have vampire parts. In particular, the one where vampires like to play baseball.
In family outfits.
In family outfits.
Family outfits.
You know, the last time my family had an outfit, it was at a family reunion, which was sort of made sense because that side of the family is just way too enormous. And so we all had t-shirts that were the same color that we could wear, you know, to match.
So you could identify each other when you were in the, like, campground bathroom or something? I think it was more so
that other people could identify us.
You all look the same, though.
No, everybody on that side of the family looks the same. They are all white and rich. And they like baseball.
No, they are not.
No, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying that, like, everybody looks the same at family reunions, and that was just sort of funny. That we had a uniform for that, and then, like, I don't know. That was kind of back before I decided that I really wanted to be a vegetarian vampire, and I didn't really fit in with them, so I had to go out on my own.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so this is going to be a little head coming to the point here, but, like, there's a essay by Nathaniel Hawthorne from, you know, like, the 1800s or whatever. Mm-hmm. And where he talks about, like, the difference between a novel and a romance, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, a novel, I mean, and I'm using the terms the way he's using them because I think we all have feelings about what that means now.
Right.
But, like, just try to peel that back and accept it on its own terms. Is that he's like, a novel is a, like, a recreation of reality, or, mm-hmm. you know, where things make sense and gravity works and there aren't, paranormal doesn't exist and whatever, you know? And then he talks about a romance is something that there's this little bit of the fantastic in it, which just sort of creates this, I mean, he wouldn't use this terminology, but it creates a redshift on everything around it, you know? Where it forces you to look at everything in a slightly different direction.
I mean, he's kind of describing what fantasy and sci-fi do.
Literally, that's what he's doing. He just uses the term romance because it meant something different.
Oh, sure.
Back in the 1800s than it does mean now.
Right, okay.
He meant it more in the, like, medieval sense. You know, like, a medieval romance are very often, like, religious parables, mm-hmm. where fantastic things happen and it shows you reality by showing you a heightened reality. And so I think that this is just true. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why it's a vampire, because we're paying attention now.
Yeah, I mean,
we're paying attention to that relationship. It is right. heightening things about both of their roles.
Right. Yeah, I don't
but
know.
Yeah, why vampires in specific? Question mark.
Well, I mean, just in the sense of like monster movies, because this was not a horror movie. Not.
No.
You know, I mean, like, I think that there were some elements of suspense. There were some, you know, action elements, but at its heart, like, it's not an action movie.
How about this? So.
But it's not a horror movie either. No, so why, you know.
But I think a lot of times the vampire stories are less horror and more gothic because they're often centered in the home often.
Of a family that is longstanding. Family, yeah.
You know, crumbling mansions and the whole nine.
Right.
I mean, obviously the Cullens are sort of subverting that because obviously they don't have a crumbling house and they have their shit in order. This is not the house of Usher or whatever.
Right.
But so we just recently watched Interview with a Vampire,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was really great. And part of the thing that I thought that the television show got right and did really well was showed how abusive their relationship is.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And so one could argue, we've got two data points here,
mm-hmm.
that having a vampire in your story will inevitably, you start talking about power dynamics within interpersonal relationships and often abusive and coercive ones.
Yeah, because I mean, I do think that that's kind of an undercurrent of the Twilight, like, movies is that, even though it's not explicit and it's, like, not supposed to be, there's an awful lot of that happening. Like, in one of the later movies, I think the next one, where they try to have sex and he flips out and hurts her, you know, because he can't control himself. He's just too strong when, you know, whatever, loses control. I mean, that was in Buffy, too, where, you know, that would happen. And I don't know. I mean, it's like, if you think about other vampire movies like Underworld or Blade or, you know, a lot of that stuff tends to be action horror. Like, the vampire movies tend to be, or I mean, I guess if you look at what was the Dracula that Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder were in? Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Yeah, that was Bram. Yeah.
I mean, because that was like, kind of gothic, but it also took itself real seriously.
Oh, I don't know. And tried to
be more faithful to the text, but it's like that Dracula text doesn't have. They don't even name check it in Twilight. Like the word is vampire. She's like vampires, but you know there was a whole Googling scene where it made it pretty clear that the rules for these vampires are specific and not Dracula. You know, and so they're their own. It's its own thing, but it's like it was through omission because there wasn't a single mention of Dracula in that whole thing. It's like a world where Dracula doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which
it's like
is
the Walking Dead, like the Night of the Living Dead doesn't exist in that world.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. That's why I can't figure out the why vampire part, because it's clear that she's doing something like more specific with it.
Right.
Like silver, garlic, ultraviolet
none of that,
light. I mean,
none
like.
Of it.
The reason they can't be in the sunlight is because, you know, humans wouldn't understand why we're so angelic looking. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
so beautiful.
She just sort of turns it into something other. It's like vampire fanfic as a, you know, I mean, it's like, let me take the idea of a vampire and do what I think should be done with it, which is like just blood drinking. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it. Everything
that's
else
kind of it.
And immortality.
Yep. Yep. Well, and we eventually get the sort of vampire Catholic Church with the Volturi. They show up. I love that.
That's
so
when
much.
It starts.
Like, that's when it goes off the rails.
It takes
it's
itself
so
less seriously, and it's just delightful. Oh my God.
I just love it so much.
Yeah. I mean, and it does turn pretty fun. I mean, it's like the Fast and the Furious movies.
It takes
you know,
them a while to get their legs under them.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the first Fast and the Furious movie is like the first Twilight movie, and that it takes itself very seriously, and there are no comedic parts. But that was actually point blank fanfic. So.
Right.
Not quite the same. But then as that series evolved, it got funnier and funnier. And I think that's what I like about the Twilight series is that it's the same kind of, it's the same media arc over the whole, the whole thing. Which is funny because, like, you know, this is my long-running theory. I don't know if you've probably heard it. The longer you go in a movie series, the higher the chance that it will eventually turn out that they're international spies.
Right, which kind of happens.
Which happens in Twilight.
Yeah,
by absolutely. The end. But we'll get there.
100%.
Obviously super rewatchable.
Super rewatchable. I mean, I'm not even going to say I'm embarrassed to say how many times I've watched it. It's got to be half a dozen, at least.
Yeah, I don't even know. But I would totally watch it again. I mean, like, it's just how long you wait. It's like Lord of the Rings, you know, you just want to wait long enough until it's like, you know, it's not that fresh.
You can reappreciate it and be like, oh my God, I forgot about in the classroom scene that he's got like a stuffed owl behind him. So it looks like he has wings and shit.
Oh yeah.
Like shit like that. Which or
the little family crest.
Yeah.
Things that I'd never really noticed before. And part of it is because it's on, you know, we got this ridiculously large TV.
Yeah.
And we need to rewatch all of these movies in high definition.
Yeah,
now.
No, but it's just, yeah, I just love it so much because it's so itself. And like, yeah, Meyer, she's such a mensch.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously she's wrong about everything, but I just love it.
Team Anna Kendrick.
Team Anna Kendrick. High five.
High five.